This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Carlson Fish Oils. Fish oil provides the vital omega-3s, EPA and DHA, which support cardiovascular, brain and nerve, vision, immune system, joint, and skin health. Carlson ensures maximum freshness by managing their fish oils from sea to shelf. All Carlson fish oils are tested by an FDA-registered laboratory for freshness, potency, and purity, and they're available in soft gels and liquid form. For more information, go to carlsonlabs.com. Carlson fish oils are available at fine health food stores nationwide. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. It's a holiday time, and this is an especially timely podcast because we're going to talk to an individual who has really, I think, something to offer to those of you who are embarking on New Year's resolutions. You know, after the holidays, people try to turn it around, and all too often, they falter in their New Year's resolutions, especially when it comes to food. Food is, it's a highly addictive substance. And today we're going to talk to an expert on the relationship between nutrition and addiction. She's Julia Ross. She's author of a fantastic book called The Mood Cure. That came out several years ago. We interviewed her at that time. It's a really wonderful book that talks about the effects of diet on mood, and a really prescient book because recent research really validates what she's been saying. Julie's a pioneer in the use of nutritional therapies for the treatment of eating disorders, addictions, and mood problems, and she's the director of several innovative programs in the San Francisco Bay Area since 1980, a true pioneer. She trains and certifies health professionals and lectures widely. She's the author of the bestsellers, The Mood Cure, and of course, I forgot The Diet Cure, which is also great. She's been everywhere, ranging from Vogue to the Journal of Molecular Psychiatry, as well as in the media, on radio, TV, and the internet. And she has a virtual clinic and training institute, which is based in Northern California. The new book is entitled The Craving Cure. Identify your craving type to activate your natural appetite control. Julie, it's a pleasure having you once again on Intelligent Medicine. It's been too long since we've talked.
It's good to hear your voice again.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. So, first of all, let's frame the issue because I think what really goes to the heart of this is why is it that so many people fail to be able to stick to a healthy diet? I mean, we see this often in medical practice. We say, okay, you've got high blood pressure, lose 20 pounds, or you've got diabetes, type 2 diabetes, lose, some weight. But people are simply unable to adhere to these programs. And you hand them a sheet of paper and say, well, eat this way, cut out the junk, but it doesn't work.
Well, let's start with the historical perspective.
Sure.
We were not born without willpower. We were intended to be able to make rational decisions about diet. And up until about 1970, we did quite well. There was sugar available, but we ate it very moderately, and we had no weight problems, and there was virtually no diabetes, too, anyway. So our current inability to protect ourselves, even from the most dire consequences of the highly addictive substances we're consuming these days, is a new phenomenon. And about 5 major dietary changes occurred in the 1970s, interrupting, this 2-million-year history of successful eating and successful optimal weight and health.
Mm-hmm. Because, obviously, if we were programmed for obesity, we never would have reached, the 20th and 21st centuries. We would have all died of, degenerative diseases. And, yes, there were all kinds of health problems that people experienced, but there was more in the way of accidents, infectious diseases, diseases due to poor sanitation, and so on, terrible plagues. But the plague of degenerative diseases is something that's a relatively modern phenomenon.
It's very modern. In my lifetime, you know, I've walked down the streets and seen no people suffering from unnatural overweight to walking down the street and the majority of the people that I see are experiencing unnatural overweight. And most of them are actually obese. So we've got more than 70% of the population overweight and more than 35% obese. And that's increasing all the time. So it's nobody's fault, except perhaps the fault of the clever food scientists who have created or taken advantage of these five dietary errors that we made in the 1970s and exposed us to new kinds of foods. And I'm using the word food advisedly. These are actually drug-like substances, now well recognized scientifically, as well as, you know, by the sufferers, as brain invasive chemicals that actually paralyze our willpower, and have depleted five areas of the brain that are responsible for maintaining our appetite, our normal, moderate pleasure in food, and giving us instead a huge, what's called in the food industry, pleasure boost, pleasure point technology is really what they've been aiming at all this time. And something happened, the first most important thing that happened in the 1970s that allowed our food to become our drugs, was that we started to use a brand new form of sugar. We were already addicted to table sugar, but we could manage maybe, a sweet a day, and that was not a big deal. It didn't interfere with our health or our weight. But when we introduced high fructose corn syrup and high fructose agave syrup and fruit syrups, we had a whole different kind of sweet experience, a much more powerful one when it comes to the brain's appetite chemistry.
And you know, this is in line with some recent revelations that, you know, just much as the tobacco industry knew well beforehand, you know, in the 1950s and 60s that cigarettes caused cardiovascular disease and cancer, yet they denied it. Similarly, the sugar industry, they undertook their own research that showed that sugar was highly addictive, that it really hijacked the brain. And just like cigarette manufacturers, they developed exquisitely addictive delivery systems for their addictive substance, for sugar, and need more and more insidious ways of introducing it into our food supply in a cynical effort to hook people. You know, it's clear from the documentation, and I think it's going to end up being a lot of blowback on the sugar industry, much as it was for the tobacco industry.
Well, one thing that that we have in terms of exposing the sugar industry's responsibility here is a tremendous effort on the part of the former head of the Food and Drug Administration, who is probably the world's greatest whistleblower. After retiring from that post, he wrote a book called The End of Overeating, which was about his experience with the food industry, and quoting them at length, acknowledging, I remember one quote in particular, he was meeting with several industry chiefs, and they all agreed, isn't it a shame that the very things that are making our products so popular and lucrative are also causing all these health problems. And that was published in 2009. So David Kessler tried to sound the alarm, and I think, in truth, everyone is alarmed, but there's something about the idea of figuring out what the food industry is doing, especially when we think of hormones and brain chemicals and so forth, that's so intimidating that no one has been able to really address what the food industry has done. You know, what part of us has been affected and how, and is there some way that we can protect ourselves? And I happen to be in an ideal position to provide that answer because I've been in the addiction and eating disorders field as a program director since 1980. And in the 1980s, later on, towards the end of the 80s, I was very fortunate to be among the addiction professionals who learned very early on that the brain really was the site of our addictive cravings. It had nothing to do with willpower, very little to do with psychological distress. We were really dealing with some sort of brain dysfunction. But then we got much luckier, and a few of these neuroscientists did clinical studies based on a very, very simple reality. And this is something that all college-level physiology students know. The five chemicals that control our appetite in the brain, most of them neurotransmitters like endorphin and serotonin that we've all heard about. It sounds very complicated and formidable, but really, it's terribly simple. The drug-like foods that we're eating now actually have an effect on these brain sites that's very simple. They end up diminishing our natural capacity to feel pleasure. So they blow up our, you know, they have a big blown up drug effect initially, and we feel all this bliss and have to have some more. But over time, our ability to have pleasure from normal food is gone. And frankly, our ability to have pleasure from life in general is depleted. So what does that actually mean? It means something very, very simple, and that is each one of these brain chemicals is dependent on a single amino acid. In other words, brain chemistry in this regard is very, very simple. These sites just need more of their basic fuel, which is a particular amino acid. And so a couple of the brain scientists in the 80s did some studies showing that providing these particular amino acids or protein concentrates as supplements turned off the cravings for drugs and drug-like foods. And some of us in the country began to hire nutritionists and provide not only a higher protein diet that contained all of the amino acids, but more importantly and quickly, we were able to provide very targeted amino acid nutritional emergency first aid, which actually takes effect very rapidly, you know, within 24 hours at the most.
As Grace Slick might have said, feed your head, right? But feed your head not with psychedelic. I mean, I know you live in San Francisco, probably near Haight-Ashbury, but I think the psychedelic era is passé, and now we're talking about feeding your head with amino acids that come from the proteins that we eat to kind of in a lock-and-key fashion revive those parts of the brain that literally been burnt out by, you know, it's almost like driving with a heavy foot. You know, you use up all your gas if you put the pedal to the metal too frequently. And that's what happens
that's
to
right.
addicts, certainly with cocaine. I mean, they have, once they stop, they have dysphoria. They just can't, they don't feel right unless they, you know, unless they're highly stimulated. And that's one of the reasons.
And the same
for
is true, of course, of heroin addicts.
Heroin alcohol,
addicts too.
You name it.
And the OD epidemic.
Maybe yeah. Harvey Weinstein's a candidate for that too, because of the stimulation that he got from his sexual antics.
Very possibly. But and so we're in luck because this craving cure is very well identified now. We know exactly how to do it, and I decided because of the nature of, you know, it's our health situation is dire. There is no, I just felt responsible. I have an answer that could help people worldwide because this is certainly now a worldwide epidemic of food ingestion, you know, mm-hmm. with zero nutritional value and tremendous drug damage. attached to it. And
it's not a one-size-fits-all approach. And I think what's unique about your book, in a way similar to The Mood Cure, is that you profile, you sort of break it down into five different craving profiles. I mean, it's not just like, okay, here, one-size-fits-all. It seems like you differentiate among different craving patterns. Can you speak to that?
Yes. The book actually revolves around the five-part craving type questionnaire, which we've been developing and modifying over the years as we've worked with people. We've worked with over 4,000 people over the last 30 years using the amino acid supplementation approach. So this is a pretty simple symptom questionnaire that allows us to know which of the five different brain aspects that control our appetite and capacity to feel pleasure is disabled, you know, is depleted. Which one needs feeding, or is there more than one? A lot of people have several types of craving because several types of their brain have been burnt out, as you say. One of the extraordinary things about sugar in particular, especially combined with other addictive substances like wheat flour and chocolate, is that in one product, all five different brain areas can be targeted. So, for example, heroin targets one, it targets the endorphins, you know, our mm-hmm. our natural pain-killing system. But sugar takes in the endorphins, the serotonin, our natural antidepressant. It affects GABA, our natural tranquilizer, and also dopamine, which is a huge factor in reward and also in stimulation and motivation. And of course, finally, it raises our blood sugar, which creates kind of a high temporarily. So you
break it down into five different types of food cravers. So if I might, I'm going to just run through them. There's the type one, depressed craver. Then there's the type two, which is the crashed craver. There's type three, the comfort craver. Type four, the stressed craver. And type five is the fatigued craver. And, you know, like you say, there may be some people who partake of two or more of these. But generally, you could sort people out in terms of this. And, you know, some of the questions include, do you have obsessive thoughts or behaviors? Do you feel edgy or irritable? Alternatively, do you crave foods for stress relief? Do you feel apathetic, bored, or flat without sugary or caffeinated foods or energy drinks? And so, by going through this questionnaire, and it's a very elaborate questionnaire, you get a score, the end of which gives you a sort of a profile of what type of craver you are. So can you speak to what the different craving types?
Sure. I'm thinking of someone in particular that who came to us in October. She and her two daughters and her husband took enormous pleasure in home-prepared or commercial sweet products of every kind and description, and she in particular was suffering the consequences both in her health and her weight, decided to stop doing it, didn't know how to go about that, you know, putting that decision into practice, and contacted us at the virtual clinic. The first thing we did was send her the questionnaire. And of the five types of craving, she had two. She was a comfort craver, and she was also a depressed craver. So the depressed craver tends to do fairly well while the sun's shining, but in the afternoon and evening is when the cravings for sugars and starches really get out of control, and that was true for her.
And that speaks to a serotonin issue, right? And
that's right. That's the deficiency of serotonin.
Yeah, when we talk about seasonal affective disorder, we actually sometimes say, well, you put these people on SSRIs, put them on, Prozac, Paxil,
Celexa.
Celexa, these types of medications.
Yes. And we do that because these are drugs that will temporarily force some activity in those serotonin-producing mm-hmm. areas of the brain. But if we give those depleted areas the amino acid that they really rely on, and can thrive on, very quickly, we just lose the symptoms. We're no longer pessimistic and worried and irritable. In fact, we have the inner sunshine that serotonin is so famous for providing.
What's the difference between a drug fix and an amino acid fix? Because, you know, some people might say, well, great, I read the book. It looks like I need some serotonin, so I'll just go to my local psychiatrist and get a prescription.
Well, let me use Gail as an example again. She had been on antidepressants in the past, but they'd accelerated her weight gain, so mm-hmm. she got off of them. But they had been temporarily helpful. So we explained that these nutrients would go into the same areas that the drugs would go into, or the drug foods would go into, but instead of plundering and overstimulating and in the long run depleting the operation of those pleasure centers, they would build them up and restore them to their original glory. These are ancient systems that, you know, are capable of giving us a tremendous sense of well-being on a constant basis. And what people find is, and Gail discovered this in the first day when we trialed her on the serotonin boosting amino acid tryptophan. Before we gave her the amino acid, we asked her what would she like to have if she could have whatever she wanted and there'd be no health or weight repercussions. And like most of the clients that we get in this area, she answered a Snickers. Mm-hmm. So we
said,
fine,
like the
we'll
commercial.
Get
you know, that's like you know, when you're hangry. You know, it's like,
yes.
You see those commercials? They're pretty funny commercials, but they give you exactly the wrong message, because the message is like, if you're feeling kind of low, take a Snickers bar and you'll feel great, but you'll, a few hours later, you'll crash and burn, unfortunately.
That's right.
It'll perpetuate
That's right. Well,
the
they're
vicious
just focusing
cycle.
On the yeah. temporary
the
effect,
quick fix.
The
yeah.
drug effect.
Yeah.
So, you know, what she found, you know, 10 minutes after taking this, this amino acid tryptophan, when we asked her again, well, what about the Snickers bar? You know, would you still like it? And she gave us a response that most of our clients give us, and that is looking at us in a kind of a blank way over Skype and saying, actually, I think I'd like some lunch. And that's the answer we're really looking for, because we're looking for a return of our real appetite.
Mm-hmm. True hunger
so that
signals.
We're not ruled yeah. by cravings.
Right.
We're back to a normal, functioning human in relation to food.
Yeah, it's funny because, I mean, I recently embarked on a paleo diet, and we'll talk a little bit about that in part two.
Good.
But on the paleo diet, what I noticed, you know, and I really cut out virtually all the sugar in my diet and reduced my because I was gluten-free bread and gluten-free, that, you know, just I really cut refined carbohydrates out. And what I noticed is that this whole, the false hunger, you know, which is like after a meal, is like, I gotta have some sweets. Well, you just ate, you know, you don't really have this tremendous craving. That's gone. But I can go for hours and hours during the day. And then I reach a certain point, you know, like maybe, you know, 12:30 or 1 o'clock in the afternoon after, you know, 7 o'clock breakfast, where I just have to eat. But it's a natural hunger. It's like my stomach is empty. I need some food and protein and fat. Maybe a little carbohydrate will suffice, but I don't, you know, want to put the feed bag on and eat, you know, a bowl of pasta.
Good.
I mean,
That's exactly right.
I mean, and I think you have to experience it to come to the conclusion that this is the way to go. Okay. So this is a good point at which to pause, because we divide our podcast into two parts. The book is The Craving Cure. We're talking to Julia Ross, who's a pioneer in this field. She works a lot via nutrition on problems related to addiction. And yes, indeed, our obsession with food is an addictive problem. It lends itself very nicely to this paradigm of supporting it with diet and nutrients. In part two, we're going to talk specifics. We're going to talk about which amino acids, you know, what, how you can determine which amino acids are for you. What are the diet do's and don'ts? This will hopefully get you started towards actually this year making good on your New Year's resolutions. It's an important time of year. People form a resolve to do better, and we're going to help you with some practical tips. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.